In the coming months and years, we're likely to pay much more to heat and cool our homes and fill our gas tanks. And there are some ways that perhaps we can mitigate that a bit by incentivizing energy companies to provide alternatives to fossil fuels. Larry Mueller here. And our guest with us now is Nick Roy, a researcher with Resources for the Future. Nick's going to explain how fees paid to the state by utility companies could result in lower energy bills for those of us here in Wisconsin. So, have you seen your energy bills increasing? Do you wonder how much more or less you would pay for clean or renewable energy? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's talk about your nonprofit, Resources for the Future. Tell us about that organization.
Yeah, so Resources for the Future is a nonpartisan, non-advocacy, nonprofit research institute based in Washington, D.C. We do a lot of work focusing on federal and state policy in the U.S., primarily using tools from economics as well as the fields of environmental science and other disciplines, mainly focusing on informing decision makers at the legislative level, but also at the executive level to think about how they can use economics to inform better decisions around resources and energy decisions.
So you're a nonprofit. How are you funded and able to operate?
Yeah, so for it changes depending on the year. Like we've had a lot more government funding until this year, but historically we also have a lot of funding from foundations and you know, we have a lot of individual contributors as well. But mostly other nonprofits that are looking to try and increase the amount of information that is around these topics.
So you're concerned certainly with the affordability of energy for the average home and business owner. What's really driving up the cost?
There's a lot of factors that have been longstanding as well as recent around electricity prices. So for many years now, we've been seeing a lot of constraints around permitting. And so that is both the permitting of transmission lines to new generation, as well as permitting for new sources of electricity generation. And that's been something that's been going on for some time now. And there's been bipartisan efforts at the federal level and several state levels to try and figure out how to sort of expedite that so we can unlock the energy resources we have in this country to be able to have lower prices. Now, in recent years, or actually really mostly this past year or two, there's been some other major trends that have begun to emerge. One is that demand growth, which has historically been relatively low in recent years, has begun to increase pretty substantially. And a big driver of that is, one driver of that is electrification of, you know, households as well as electric vehicles. But one that's been getting a lot more attention in the news lately has been AI data centers. And this is because of how much electricity is needed to be able to scale up this somewhat national priority, as well as booming economic sector in our economy. And then I'd say a third aspect of what is driving up these prices tends to be, or is the fact that there was a lot of subsidies towards clean generation being directed towards new solar and wind, as well as other technologies that are have zero emissions from the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. In the reconciliation package that was just passed by the House here in Washington, D.C. in August, there was a lot of removal of those tax credits, especially for wind and solar, and especially for the coming years. And so as utilities are looking to plan new generation, they now have less subsidies that they can use to provide that generation at a lower cost, while they're simultaneously still facing these major barriers for siting that new generation, as well as transmission, and having to meet the demand of these AI data centers, which are have a great amount of electricity needed to operate for their purposes.
Do we know how much, I mean, these data centers, how much additional energy are they consuming?
Well, right now, because it's been such a rapidly growing industry, I'm not sure that the data has fully come out on exactly how much of an impact they're making. I will say that we have seen increases of electricity demand in the past year that were, I believe you could, what's the right number for it? Somewhere close to 10, a little over 10% higher than what we had expected in previous years. I guess what projected electricity demand was going to be for last year was about 10% higher in actuality. And that doesn't account for just how much demand we're expecting in this year. The nice thing about the power sector is because it's, you know, sort of this giant machine, the grid, there's a lot of planning that goes on. And so when these new data centers want to come online, they still have to work with utilities and so on to try and figure out how to become this very large load, and how the utilities and the grid operators can plan for that large load. So I would say that it's what's a big part of their effect on prices isn't necessarily how much they're demanding today, but how much they might demand in the future. And because of the uncertainty of exactly how much AI is going to play a role in, or the success of the AI and data centers that are needed to power it, the impact in terms of size is still kind of unknown. And I think they're trying to figure that out right now.
Yeah.
In the coming years, we'll have a lot more information on that.
Yeah, sure. And I know Wisconsin, I mean, we're looking at some big data centers, or at least one very large data center coming into the state, mm-hmm. which could have an impact on our state.
Yeah, and what's interesting also about Wisconsin is that there's, you know, obviously you're part of MISO, the Mid-Continental Independent System Operator, which is like sort of the grid that you share with other states. And there's other states nearby in MISO that are contribute to the prices that Wisconsinites pay and that utilities have to face that are scaling up and have been scaling up data centers for a while now. So Illinois and Iowa are big, are in the top 15 states in terms of their data center, how much demand that consumes for their state electricity. And so while there are some arguments for having data centers in states, like you could get economic benefits from those jobs, Wisconsinites might be paying for other states to get those economic benefits in the electricity rates they face. And so it isn't just the case that you can say we don't want data centers in Wisconsin. You're going to have to pay for the data centers that you that share the same grid you do in other states.
Okay, and so how many other states are there? There's like four or five other states, and we're kind of paying for some of that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't know the specifics of MISO. It is one of the larger, I'm pulling up a map now, just so I can better answer you there. I just know that it's one of the larger independent system operators, and it spans several states. And, you know, whatever decisions are decided about how they want to integrate AI data centers into their state economic profile, like that does partially play into the increased demand that drives up electricity prices.
Well, we've got a lot more to talk about. Wisconsin's one of the eight states that has clean energy policies. We're going to be talking about that. And certainly we're going to be talking about carbon pricing with our guest, Nick Roy, research associate, works on national and state energy policy resources for the future. It's a research nonprofit focused on environmental and economic policies. And he will be with us right up until 12:30 today, if I'm not mistaken. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on WPR, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about carbon pricing today with Nick Roy. Nick's a research associate for Resources for the Future. It's a research nonprofit focused on environmental and economic policy and based in Washington, D.C. You can join the conversation with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you, and we will get to the caller we have online in just a minute. But I want to go back to Wisconsin's clean energy policies. I think Nick, you wrote an issue brief that says Wisconsin is one of 8 states with clean energy policies. How would you describe Wisconsin's commitment to clean energy?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, because I was thinking in particular, when we picked the states we looked at states that had what's known as renewable portfolio standard, which is essentially, or clean energy standards. There's sort of 2 different names for the same thing. And they essentially are ways of requiring a certain percentage of electricity provided to Wisconsinites, in this case, come from clean energy. And that percentage increases over time. And there's basically a crediting system that emerges such that the utilities that have a less clean mix pay the utilities that have a cleaner mix to be able to meet this statewide target. Now, Wisconsin's RPS hasn't been updated in some time. I think it was set at 10% and hadn't increased much greater than that. And I don't follow this very closely. This was more of like something that we were checking if there was states that had these policies. So it could be that there is active activity around that policy that I'm unaware of. But that hasn't stopped utilities from setting goals. I mean, from what I understand, I think all but one utility in Wisconsin has an 80% clean by 2030 target, or 80% below 2005 emissions levels. Those actually tend to be very similar when we're looking at national level, at least. 80% below 2005 is often the same as 80% clean. And actually, in this analysis, that was the exact policy that we modeled. We said, what if there was, instead of a RPS crediting system, what if we had an emissions trading system, which is another way of basically generating a carbon price. The details are kind of nuanced to get to, but essentially a carbon price can arise from meeting this target of 80% that all these utilities have. And so actually what we modeled here is sort of the cost that in theory utilities would already be paying, but if they face increased demand and that starts to lead to some backsliding on their goals, which are pretty much voluntary and it's hard to enforce, then this policy would be a way of holding those utilities accountable while also raising some revenues. And in the way we described it, those revenues could go back to households.
And we'll go into more detail on that, but I think in 2022, wind projects made up around 19% of solar, and solar accounted for about 3% of the state's total electricity generation. So we got wind and we got solar there, which is getting larger. And Mary Kay in Kenosha actually had a question about solar.
Let's
go there. Mary Kay, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. My question to you about solar is solar farms, okay? Wisconsin is using up its farmland. People live near these solar farms, okay? We've never been told the health effects to the public and to the landscape. There's no signs, no warnings that you're near one when you're driving past one. And in the winter, the panels, because we have rough winters in Wisconsin, the panels are going to break, and there's chemicals in those panels. So I don't understand why we just don't use what we already have, use less, and they get a tax credit for trying to help.
Mary Kay, thanks for calling. Nicholas, Nick, what do you say?
Yeah, so I'm not a public health expert that can speak to the specific chemicals in solar panels and how they affect downstream. But of course, energy is a big concern in terms of our energy sources and how that interacts with our health. I would point to the fact that oftentimes what we already have tends to be what is polluting our air and water much more than, from what we understand today, solar panels or wind turbines could do. So when you look at coal, the amount of SO2 or sulfur dioxide that is released, that can have serious health implications and can lead to a lot of people dying. Now, the intersection that you bring up is particularly interesting when it comes to farms and the agricultural aspect of, you don't want your food to have chemicals that are poor. And I don't know the interactions in particularly of solar or coal on the downstream impacts on the agriculture sector. But there's definitely a lot of documented evidence about the harm that our existing coal and natural gas and fossil fuel supply tends to have on our public health. And I'd be interested in looking into the research on how it could affect downstream agricultural impacts. I think another thing I'd point out is that these fossil plants, coal and natural gas, one of the things that we're talking about a lot in this paper is climate. those are going to affect global temperatures, and as well as conditions for agriculture are going to change as global temperatures increase over time. And so that could be a major impact on farmers in Wisconsin. The specifics, again, there are less of what I'm aware of. And I'd be really happy to talk with someone who, and maybe Larry, you want to have someone on who can talk about the intersection of agriculture and climate, as well as the intersection of fossil fuel generation and agricultural impacts.
Let's turn to talk a little bit more about the whole carbon pricing thing. Wisconsin does not have a policy of carbon pricing, but
no.
talk a bit more about what really carbon pricing is, and what are the details as you know them.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about that last question, the fundamental idea of carbon pricing is to have polluters pay. And so the pollution that you're making them pay for is the hidden tax that households already face of carbon dioxide when it comes to climate damages, as well as the associated sulfur oxide and nitrous oxide that comes from these plants. We've actually had a emissions pricing system exist across the U.S. for some time that eliminated acid rain. Historically, that was a major achievement of the Clean Air Act that I'm sure Wisconsinites, as well as many others, have benefited from across the U.S. But what this policy in particular does, instead of thinking about acid rain, it's thinking about the effects of climate change and focusing on making polluters pay for their carbon dioxide emissions. And there's two benefits there. One is that you're incentivizing less emissions. So the existing generation is going to cost more if it's polluting. So if you have coal or natural gas plants that that have high CO2, then they become less economic. I mean, it's already the case that they are, or coal plants in particular, have relatively uneconomic as is today. And a lot of what's supporting them is that increase in demand while the supply is constrained because of permitting. So you're getting increased demand from the data centers, which is forcing the use of these polluting resources, while simultaneously you can't meet that demand with cheaper and cleaner renewables or clean energy. And sorry, I just was thinking again about that last input from the caller. And another point to make is that with carbon pricing, it doesn't necessarily say you got to build solar or wind. It actually leaves it to the market to come up with the solution. So there's other resources such as geothermal or nuclear, which maybe people have concerns about themselves as well. But it doesn't have to be left solely to the carbon price to decide what technology it is. You know, the PSC as well as your legislatures can provide other incentives beyond a carbon price to be able to direct what energy sources are used. What a carbon price does is it puts a price on carbon and gets those revenues, as well as makes those polluters pay that tax they're already making households pay. And we can talk a bit more about what you can do with the revenues, I guess, if you have any question on that, but
yeah.
I want to make sure address the carbon pricing idea well.
Well, one that comes to mind right away in terms of what you can do with it, part of it, at least I would think, would go back to the consumer.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and that's the revenue usage we describe in the report. I mean, with the subsidies pulled away from renewables and other clean energy sources right now, the revenues you could generate from a carbon price can actually perfectly supplement. And in other states, it would exceed the levels those subsidies did. In Wisconsin, it's actually much closer 1-to-1 in our analysis. But yeah, those revenues, if you give them back to households, they actually will see a decrease in their electricity rates while also having a cleaner grid. Now, it's important to note that that's only if you address some of these broader concerns of permitting that we brought up at the beginning, which make it harder to be able to integrate these new energy sources. And if, you know, locals are concerned about the integration of those resources, it's going to take some time to reconcile those concerns and figure out how to properly address them while to also be able to capture the benefit of that carbon pricing. Now, one thing to note is those revenues are collected across the cost of generating across the entire power sector. So households are just one component of the power sector. If you are a data center, you're not a household. You are part of the industrial or commercial sector. And what happens is if you rebate households with those carbon pricing revenues that you've collected, you're basically making those not only the polluters pay, but if the polluters pass on the cost to ratepayers, you're shielding households from that potential cost pass-through. And the other sectors that are increasing demand in the electricity sector are the ones who are going to face that increase in price.
So those companies, well, they're users, they're not producers, so they're not paying a carbon. Well, they would be paying it, I guess.
And it depends on how there's a couple different ways to do it. One could be that you integrate. I mean, this is the interesting thing about carbon pricing. There's so many different ways to iron out the details and implementation. In some cases, you could give the allowances for free and just give less and less over time. In that case, you're not going to get any revenues to redistribute. But if you do that, you could have utilities that have cleaner energy will have more revenues because they will be selling their allowances to other utilities that have dirtier programs, kind of similar to the RPS system that has existed historically. And when they do that, you could require that, especially because there's regulated utilities in Wisconsin, you could require that they give those revenues back to households. So that's one way that could be done. But it could also be the case that if you're sort of requiring the polluters all to pay and they have to pay the government based on the carbon price that is set or the goal that is set that creates a carbon price, then there's a question of how much those utilities pass that on to ratepayers. And the point that we're making here is that in theory, they're likely to pass it either entirely to, you know, all customer classes or figure out a way to sort of distribute it across these different types of ratepayers. And if you have all these revenues left over, it's good to target households to receive those revenues instead of giving it to all of the other sectors.
And so that revenue, I mean, so consumers, but also I'm thinking that it could go to expansion of clean energy.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point too, that other states have thought of doing this. There's these concepts called greenhouse gas reduction funds, which are thinking about how we use those revenues to invest in that. But when I looked at Wisconsin State Energy Plan, something that stood out to me was the investments, particularly in workforce development. I mean, when you look outside of the United States, there's a lot of growth in these technologies when it comes to solar and wind and advanced nuclear and so on that don't produce carbon dioxide. And if our industrial workforce falls behind and becomes too committed to energy that is, you know, dependent on volatile global markets or, you know, finite resources instead of the infinite resources that are wind and solar, then it could be that, you know, that could have extreme workforce implications in the long run. And so what I liked about looking at Wisconsin's clean energy plan that I believe the governor's office conducted was that they talked a lot about this sort of workforce development angle. And that to me is a great way to use these revenues as well, because it's not giving the money, you know, you're not taking it from, you know, the power sector and then giving it back to the power sector to invest into the clean energy. You're, you know, taking it from the power sector and you're saying, now let's invest it in jobs that can help lower the cost or accelerate the role households and constituents have in that transition that's occurring.
That's cool. Michael emailed to say only 20% of our energy diet comes from electricity. The remainder is mostly fossil fuels. Will carbon prices affect the 80% non-electric fossil fuel use?
So what we describe in this paper that we were talking about here is specifically focusing on a carbon price on the power sector. So it's mostly about switching the fuels from polluting electricity generation to non-polluting electricity generation over time. And you can apply a similar concept across an entire economy. Like you could include oil refineries, you could include cement and limestone and other sectors that do create a lot of CO2. But that we haven't analyzed the impacts of that in this paper here. Two states in the U.S. have these policies where they cover other sectors. So that's Washington and California. And the European Union is starting to expand there, as well as China. They have a carbon price that is starting to cover more sectors. So there are programs that are already addressing this, but really it's hard to think about decarbonizing these other sectors. So like, you know, getting people to switch to electric vehicles, for example, if you aren't prioritizing emissions reductions in the power sector first. And that's because most emissions reductions from those other sectors rely on electrification. And if your grid is still powered by fossil fuels, you might not be producing CO2 emissions with your electric vehicle, but if that electric vehicle is charged on a dirty grid, well, then the impacts are somewhat offset. So I think that's the reason we focus particularly on the power sector here. But of course, in the long run, and especially as you know, if we get really serious about addressing our climate goals, then other sectors become a higher priority as well.
So we've got the federal government phasing out tax credits for clean energy. How will this affect the cost of energy for the average American?
Yeah, so this has been an open question in some ways because of the fact that there is a lot of uncertainty around exactly how this phase out is going to play out. There's in the way that the law has been interpreted by the Treasury Department, there's still sort of leaving some room for legal interpretation about exactly if a project can receive these tax credits if it is built in 27, in 28, 29. There's sort of open questions about exactly how the prices are going to change. In a separate analysis from this, we found that the repeal of these tax credits is expected to increase electricity prices by 6 to 8%. That includes some demand growth projections. But of course, if demand continues to grow beyond expectations like it has historically, and we don't resolve some of our larger transmission issues and the costs that they impose on the power sector, well, then that could look a lot more significant. One thing that has been an idea floating around Washington as well as other states is thinking about not even necessarily clean energy versus dirty energy, but just the fact that we need cheap energy right now because of all this demand growth. And one thing that's nice about clean energy is that it is relatively cheap. And what is helpful about these carbon prices is while they might be increasing the cost of dirty energy, that dirty energy is probably only going to stay online if you're having demand growth from, like we've said, data centers or some other customer class that can kind of afford to keep these plants online. You see this in, there's retired plants in the East Coast, that such as Three Mile Island, which had a nuclear disaster. Mm-hmm. Microsoft bought Three Mile Island and basically kept it going, even though it was expected to retire in the near future. And so and that's very costly energy because of the fact that there was a nuclear meltdown with that. So and you see this too with coal plants that were expected to close and data centers bringing them online just so that they can supply their energy. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that, you know, if the data centers are the reason that dirty fossil stays online and how we meet their rising demand, then maybe households should be receiving some of the benefits too, and also being compensated for some of the costs that dirty energy is going to have on their health and the climate.
It seems like here we're talking about this in a state-by-state level, which suggests that the state should do it if the federal government won't.
Yeah, I mean, this is really an opportunity, I think, to show what it looks like to be able to care about your environment while also doing things, while also addressing affordability concerns. I mean, that is a sort of central question that is going on nationally, as well as in most states, is questions of how can we lower costs. And the environmental concerns have somewhat been characterized historically, and I think mischaracterized in a lot of ways, as something that increased costs. Like if you care about the environment, that must increase costs. But the reality is that most of us pay costs for not caring about our environment all the time. Like I said, with air pollution, water pollution, and climate pollution. And so really the goal here is especially a state like Wisconsin in the Midwest, there isn't any major carbon pricing systems that exist, but there has been clean energy policy thought about throughout the Midwest. I think this is a real opportunity to show how to implement a policy in a smart way that is different from the sort of coastal states that have already implemented carbon pricing. And that's because the coastal states have other constraints and other regulations that they tend to couple with carbon pricing. But if Wisconsin were to implement only carbon pricing and do this rebate in this way, it could really show how if states simplified their policy approach towards the environment, that that's part of what can make energy more affordable and our environments much cleaner.
Have you received any support for your proposal from Wisconsin lawmakers?
Well, we don't do any advocacy at Resources for the Future, so we're entirely just trying to provide information into this space. And in a lot of ways, we're really floating ideas, and we're not trying to push this idea. I think I leave it to democracy and the legislative process to be able to figure out exactly what works for Wisconsinites. I will say that we haven't been, because of that non-advocacy approach, we tend to not lobby, but we do work with legislatures if they have questions, specifically technical ones. And so I really hope today that through this conversation, you know, some constituent starts thinking about this, maybe gets involved in some local policy thinking, and that they start to reach a point where, whether it's carbon pricing or other environmental policy, that we could maybe work with Wisconsin legislatures to think about this kind of policy.
Yeah, and we do have occasionally, for sure, have Wisconsin lawmakers listening to this program. So maybe we're making a little providing some information for them. The seven state, why you picked those seven states? And
yeah.
What are the other? Is Arizona?
Who are the Colorado? Other? Yeah, I mean, I need to pull up.
It doesn't matter.
New Mexico, Michigan. Michigan's on there. Illinois, another, and Minnesota. All your neighbors, except for Iowa.
So, would it make sense to have the seven getting together at all and talking about this?
That is a really great question, and that is something that we see in the Northeast. So there's a 10-state carbon pricing system in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that exists right now, and they work together to basically implement their carbon pricing system. And that program recently had an update that was focusing on addressing affordability concerns that I think was pretty successful, according to most market watchers and economists who are paying attention to that. The one thing to note that's really beneficial about having these states come together and collaborate is that if you have a target spread out across the multi-states, which, as we mentioned before, you might be sharing a grid, so you might as well do it that way anyway, it allows you to find more cost-effective ways to reduce emissions. And so that means that the price of electricity, even on those who will pay for it, even if they don't get a rebate, like households will, as we proposed, that impact will be lower. So that's one benefit. The other is, to your caller's point earlier, if people don't want to have solar panels in their backyard, or they're worried that the land's going to be used because Wisconsin is such an important agricultural hub for the Midwest, then maybe it makes sense to figure out other locations within the grid that supplies the Midwest electricity where you could place solar or wind or offshore wind even. I mean, the Great Lakes region has a lot of wind around it because of its geography. And so I think that's another example of a technological opportunity. Or perhaps you have, you know, some part of these other states that is really, really excited about these new technologies, and maybe less so than Wisconsin. And so you could have a combined system where you still reach the same reductions in CO2 in terms of climate impacts, and you'll do it more cost effective, and you'll have it in places where people actually want these technologies. At the same time, I would note that you do lose a little bit of the benefit of the reduced emissions, as well as the workforce development opportunities, if you don't deploy those technologies in your state.
Yeah, fascinating. And I really enjoyed reading your piece. Nick, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. Now, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk again down the road. Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Larry. I hope so, too.
Nick Roy, a research associate working on national and state energy policy, Resources for the Future, a research nonprofit focused on environmental and economic policies. Great to have him with us. And coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk with you about prescribed burning and how you might become a burn boss. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.